these terrorists have a cause or possess the guts to take their own life in order to indulge in mass killings. The Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies have first-hand experience of the tactics of the dastardly Daesh terrorists, who were defeated and decimated in Syria and Iraq by the forces of the Axis of Islamic Resistance, to the horror of the U.S., which has now transferred these terrorists in thousands to Afghanistan while trying to revive them in the aforesaid Arab countries. Recently, on his arrival in Kabul, Iran's special envoy to Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Ghoumi, who had served with destination in Iraq following the American occupation of that country, said the United States is propping up Daesh terrorists to perpetrate various acts of terror in Afghanistan in the wake of Washington's failure after more than two decades of its destructive presence. Kazemi Ghoumi, who had earlier served as head of the Iranian consulate in Herat, Western Afghanistan, and is fully familiar with the conditions prevailing in our northeastern neighbor, said the aggressor country, the United States, that sought to rule Afghanistan for the past 20 years is now trying to reinforce Takfiri groups after its defeat. He offered Iran's help in weeding out the Daesh terrorists in view of the Islamic Republic's successful experience against these cowardly American agents in Iraq and Syria. The Taliban, which is currently in control of Afghanistan and has assured the Afghan people of its intentions to counter Daesh terrorism, should accept Iran's brotherly suggestion if it is serious in combating these dangerous American terrorists, who are also aligned with the illegal Zionist entity. Any laxity in this regard, or the mere claim of countering Daesh by the Taliban, as the report suggests, of targeting them in Kandahar and other places, may prove detrimental to Afghanistan's security, stability, and unity in view of the ruling Taliban's lack of experience in this particular field, and the devilry of the U.S. in boosting the ranks of the terrorists through the forces they had stealthily groomed over the years on the pretext of training the now dissolved Afghan army of the former regime. The Islamic Republic had also cautioned the previous government in Kabul of the Daesh menace, but it failed to heed the words of advice which the Taliban owe not to ignore on the assumption that Daesh terrorists are not a security threat and only a headache.
Torture, by definition, is the deliberate infliction of severe pain or suffering on a person for a specific purpose, such as forcing them to confess or provide information. but sometimes being indifferent to a harsh condition of the victim can also amount to torture. By many accounts, torture, in all its forms and shapes, has been a permanent fixture behind Israeli bars. But the question is, what leads to such scenes in Israeli jails? Every single day, Palestinian political activists get arrested by Israeli forces. It doesn't matter where they are, Israeli soldiers detain them at their homes, military checkpoints, or elsewhere.
Since 1967, there are altogether 800,000 Palestinians, men, women, and children, that have been jailed in Israeli prisons. And this is completely, of course, illegal. This is a way to terrorize and to discourage Palestinians to stay on their lands.
Sometimes heavily armed soldiers storm into Palestinian houses in the middle of the night to further intimidate the victims and their families. Most detainees are first transferred to unknown locations and exposed to a series of humiliating treatments, including assault, strip searching, and solitary confinement. In jail, the Palestinians experience every possible form of systematic torture, repression, and harassment. There are around 4,850 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, including 41 women, 225 children, and 540 administrative detainees. While these are official figures, activists believe the numbers are much higher. There are occasions an activist suddenly vanishes from the society and doesn't contact their relatives. For interrogating these detainees, Israel routinely used methods that constituted ill-treatment and even torture until the late 1990s. Then, Israel's Supreme Court outlawed torture, but left the door open to what it called moderate physical pressure. Based on the new ruling, interrogators of Israel's spy agency, Shin Bet, are permitted to use psychological pressure and a moderate degree of physical pressure. This is what Israeli authorities are telling the world, but in practice, the interrogation methods go far beyond a reasonable interpretation of the term moderate physical pressure. Shin Bet claims that these practices are used against detainees to prevent what it calls terrorism, a word which has lost its meaning since it's being used by the Israeli regime and its ilk to justify their crimes against humanity. There are several joint research reports conducted by rights groups based on hundreds of testimonials given by Palestinian prisoners that says Shin Bet routinely employs psychological and physical abuse in interrogations. Their methods combine use of holding conditions and interrogation methods constitutes abuse and inhuman, degrading treatment, at times even amounting to torture. Reports suggest that what is regularly employed against Palestinians in Shin Bet interrogations is in blatant violation of international law and basic moral standards.
We have all these declarations and all these condemnations and all these human rights and international laws, but it is a fact that almost a million Palestinians since 1967 have gone through the interrogations, the tortures, the imprisonment, and that's just the people, and there's the whole families around them.
The Palestinians who have undergone such interrogation recounted being held in inhuman conditions, including narrow, windowless cells that are sometimes moldy and foul-smelling. They said the cells were constantly lit with artificial lighting that is painful to the eyes. Some detainees reported being held in solitary confinement, completely cut off from their surroundings. Some reported exposure to extremes of heat and cold, as well as sleep deprivation. Many described abominable hygienic conditions. Among other things, they stated that the prison authorities do not allow them to shower, change clothes, brush their teeth, or even use toilet paper. The food is intentionally poor in quality and quantity, and detainees lose weight while in custody. In the interrogation room, they're forced to sit bound to a chair without moving for hours and even days on end. The interrogators threaten the detainees, including threats to harm their relatives, as well as shouting and employing violence against them.
I suffered from smear campaigns, I suffered from death threats, I suffered from detention, arrest, physical attacks on me. So I was arrested uncountable time now. They used to arrest me 2 times a week or detain me 2 times a day.
There are many Palestinians who have reported severe psychological strain because of torture during their detention, particularly at interrogation centers where they are completely isolated from the outside for long periods. Most Palestinians who were physically or mentally abused in interrogation have no way of complaining until the interrogation is over. This is because Palestinian detainees are regularly denied the right to meet with counsel. In the meantime, the complaints never ended in favor of Palestinians. Just in the past 2 decades, 1,300 torture complaints were filed against Shin Bet, but barely any criminal investigations were launched. Even as investigations deepened, there has still not been a single indictment. Israeli activists, along with Palestinians, have time and again called for independent investigation against Shin Bet and other Israeli policing units for the way they treat Palestinian detainees. So far, most cases are resulting in cleaning Shin Bet's name. With Israel's indifference and the silence of the international community, Palestinian resistance fronts try to take the matter in their own hands. Since 2001, not a single criminal investigation has been launched into a complaint against the Shin Bet interrogator, despite hundreds of complaints being lodged with the relevant authorities. Although formal changes have been made to the apparatus charged with looking into these complaints, so far no real action has been taken to alter the situation. Hundreds of complaints, zero criminal investigations. A report by Palestinian Human Rights released in 2018 shows that more than 200 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli prisons since 1967 to torture, lack of medical care, or gunshot wounds.
An Israeli soldier used to step on my leg with his boots and shake my bed to cause me more pain. He kept threatening to send me to prison. I came back and I knew I would lose my leg because it was all black and rotten. I am now living in a prison. I can't walk or move around anymore.
The Palestinian children in military detention is another concerning issue. A report released in July 2018 by the Center for Palestinian Prisoner Studies says that the number of children arrested increased by 30% compared to the same period in 2017 when 380 children were arrested by Israeli forces. Multiple rights groups have time and again urged UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to launch a special committee to probe Palestinian deaths in Israeli prisons. But so far, nothing has changed for the Palestinians.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. even contemplating sanctions, the EU is actually on the cusp of bolstering its relations with the Israeli regime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nasser, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Is the EU really shocked about the killing of a Palestinian boy?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A Palestinian child was killed by the Zionist regime forces recently. Mohammad Amjad Daras had gone to the village of Deir al-Hatab near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, where the Israeli regime forces were attacking Palestinian youth with tear gas canisters and stun grenades. Palestinians were protesting the encroachment of the Jewish colony of Ilun Mor on land that was violently seized from the village. Mohammad 15 was with other boys from the New Askar refugee camp on the outskirts of Nablus, according to the human rights group Defense for Children International Palestine. The boy walked closer to the troops approximately 30 minutes after he arrived. An Israeli sniper shot him in the abdomen when he was 50 meters away. Mohammed was transferred to Rafidiyah Hospital in Nablus in a private car while bleeding profusely. He was pronounced dead an hour after he arrived. Muhammad's 10th grade classmates laid a shrine on his desk as they mourned for him. The European Union's representatives in the West Bank city of Ramallah issued a statement expressing shock over the killing of Daras, describing it as the disproportionate use of lethal force. The EU did not say what level of lethal force it would consider proportionate, nor did the EU diplomats call for any sanctions to be imposed on the Zionist regime. Rather than contemplating sanctions, the EU is actually on the cusp of bolstering its relations with the Israeli regime. Talks on the Zionist regime's participation in EU's new program on scientific research have concluded, and it is likely that an accord will be signed before the end of this year. Known as Horizon Europe, that program has a total budget of around $110 billion between now and 2017. While EU diplomats in Ramallah may claim to be shocked, there is nothing out of ordinary about Mohammed's killing. So far this year, 15 Palestinian children have been killed by the Zionist regime in the West Bank, including its Al-Quds. And more than 60 children were killed in Gaza when the Zionist regime bombarded it for 11 consecutive days during May. Meanwhile, new details have emerged regarding the Israeli regime's killing of a boy in August. Imad Khaled Hashash, 15, and his brother Mohammed, 19, were awoken by the Israeli regime forces raiding Balata refugee camp in Nablus during the early hours of 24 August. The two brothers went up to the roof of their house to see what was happening as the Israeli regime forces were invading the camp and firing at Palestinians there. The Israeli regime army claimed that there was a violent disturbance of the peace. The military alleged that someone on the roof held a large object in his hand and attempted to throw it below. An Israeli regime troop was prompted to open fire as a result, the military claimed. But that's a complete lie. An investigation by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem found. The group said there was no disturbance of the peace at the time. Imad Hashash was standing on the roof of his home with his brother filming the troops as they were leaving the camp. The killing was witnessed by Imad's brother Mohammed and by a relative standing on a building opposite. The witnesses corroborated each other's testimonies. Muhammad told Betslem, "I told Imad to get back, but he wanted to see what was happening and was filming it on his phone. I pulled him back. Imad went closer to the edge of again to see what was going on, and then I heard a shot and Imad fell face down on the floor." Brother's relative, 25-year-old Ali Hashash, was standing on the roof of his home watching what was happening in the neighborhood when Imad was killed. Ali told Betslem, "I noticed one of the troops looking up and aiming his weapon. I signaled to Imad that he should get back, that the troops were below. The street is well lit and we could see each other," he added. "Imad went back a bit, and so did I, so the troops wouldn't see me. Then Imad went forward again and looked down, and I heard a gunshot followed by screams coming from his house." Muhammad and Ali described how the Israeli regime forces then fired tear gas canisters near their home. Imad's killing has left his family in a state of grief. Muhammad said, "I can't understand why my brother is killed. I looked at him, and it was like a nightmare. We used to sleep on a mattress on the floor next to each other every night. If we hadn't heard the damn noises outside, Imad would be in school with his friends today." Imad's father, Khaled Hashash, recounted how his son had joked with him earlier that night about wanting to get married that day. Khaled recalled, "He tickled me under my armpit and I started laughing. Imad loved to joke around, but I didn't know that it would be last time he would joke with me. I wish I had known. He was an innocent, smiley, cheerful little boy who lit up our home and the whole neighborhood in joy. They killed him without any warning, for no reason at all." Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Godzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centers on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Song founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Song family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of a federal savings bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
if you were going to pick on a bank, family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese.
When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He's lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute. Maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, their whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang
herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up to 5:30 a.m. He has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean. So I'm always running around.
You better eat now.
Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. Right? In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it, is very interesting. I've really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story. Like, you care deeply about the family, get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams, and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably, the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this. They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Sung family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the, I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in you get a lot of the, you're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back, and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest.
Mm-hmm. And Clive, would you agree, what did you make of the Sung's family's challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually bring them, ship them into pleading guilty, and they fail.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically he's offered a plea deal, and then they just says, no, I'm not gonna take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, that's they
see this right all the way
to
the end.
Yeah, they don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as you say, it cost them $10 million. So another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. What was happening in the subprime crisis is what people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, unlike Abacus Bank, which have really well documented loans. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who was giving out.
There is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
I'm a former prosecutor. I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, and the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small-town community, what feels like a small-town community, and helping people with small businesses, and he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing a run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, you know, trust me, you know me, I'm here, you know, your money's safe, and it worked.
It was an
incredible
moment.
Scene, actually.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, you know, they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and cop a plea for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such as demonizing a community, but clearly it had that effect. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks. So there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the DA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers. Or, you know, he sort of lists another,
ethnic
groups. Yeah, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea, anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still does. She hates the city, you know. She's like me. We both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder if any other bank CEOs are this caring. Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion. And she's sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real feel
for it. But
then it just highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney, Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control
the
levers of power.
And we saw this in our country as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control the nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching this documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sung family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no. But you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that DA Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of brilliant statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect. Well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
Well, certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
That's a spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. It makes you angry a little bit and it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's all for the better. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive. Would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. And so that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And we'll come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
As the Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May, people across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of Israeli regime's crimes. But Meta and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nasser, journalist. This article is published under the heading How Meta or Facebook Helps Israeli Regime Hide Its Crimes. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May. People across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of the Zionist regime's crimes. But Meta, or Facebook, and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. A new report by Human Rights Watch confirms that the two social media platforms, both owned by Meta, did indeed suppress and remove content in many cases, erroneously or unjustifiably. But Meta's acknowledgement to HRW of errors and unjustified removals was, at best, insufficient. It failed to address the scale and scope of reported content restrictions or adequately explain why they occurred in the first place, the watchdog said. Last week, Facebook, or Meta, announced it was hiring an outside consultancy to investigate accusations that it was censoring content favorable to Palestinians. There is plenty of evidence of suppression for the investigators to look into. In the period May 6 to 19th, which includes the Zionist regime attack on Gaza, Palestinian digital rights group Hamle denounced 500 instances of Palestinians' speech rights being violated online. They include removing content, account closures, blocked hashtags, and altering reachability of specific content. The vast majority of these violations, around 85%, occurred on Meta and Instagram, including the deletion of stories. Almost half of takedowns were done without prior warning or notice, and another 20% did not specify the reason for the removal. In one instance, Instagram restricted the use of hashtag Al-Aqsa in English and Arabic, which refers to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. After Hamle challenged the company, the hashtag was reinstalled. Hamle also observed an increase in geo-blocking on Meta technology that restricts access based on a user's location. Some posts that Instagram purged were simply reposts of content from major media organizations that could not remotely be construed as inciting violence or hatred. But Instagram labeled them as such, suggesting that the platform is restricting freedom of expression on matters of public interest, according to Human Rights Watch. Even when social media companies recognized errors and restored content, the damage was already done. Human Rights Watch said the error impedes the flow of information concerning human rights at critical moments. The group called for an external probe into Meta suppression practices. In one instance, Meta removed a post by a user in Egypt with more than 15,000 followers. The user had shared an Al Jazeera news item about the Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas. Initially, Meta deleted the post under its Dangerous Individuals and Organizations Community Standard, which prohibits specific organizations and individuals from having a presence on the platform. Meta later restored the post after the case was reviewed by its oversight board. The board concluded the post continued no praise, support, or representation. The oversight board also criticized the weakness of the policy and demanded that Meta explicitly define what constitutes praise, support, or representation. The oversight board is sometimes critical of company policy and claims to be independent, but alarms were raised last year when Meta appointed former Israeli official Amy Palmer as a member. Palmer spent years at the Zionist regime's justice ministry enforcing censorship of Palestinians' speech. Human Rights Watch urged Meta to publish its Dangerous Individuals and Organizations list, a recommendation previously made by the Oversight Board, but Meta has consistently refused to do so, claiming it would harm its employees. Recently, The Intercept published a leaked version of the list. It names over 4,000 people and groups, including politicians, writers, charities, hospitals, hundreds of music acts, and long-dead historical figures, The Intercept reported. The list of those Meta deems dangerous largely coincides with those the United States and the Zionist regime regard as enemies, but it goes much further than that. It includes the deceased 14-year-old Kashmiri child, Mudassir Rashid Perey, over 200 musical acts, television stations, a video game studio, airlines, the medical university working, and a long list of figures, The Intercept said. As well as Hamas and its military wing, the list includes the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime considers virtually all Palestinian political parties to be terrorist organizations, a pretext to routinely arrest Palestinians for political activity. Even though the Zionist regime military regularly commits massacres of entire Palestinian families, crimes against children, extrajudicial executions, and forced expulsions, it is not deemed dangerous enough to make it to Meta's list. And the Zionist regime still regularly uses Meta to threaten more violence. For instance, the Zionist regime military habitually posts direct threats of collective punishment against 2 million Palestinian civilians in Gaza. In May, the Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz used Meta to threaten more destruction than he ordered in Gaza in 2014. Back then, as the Israeli regime's army chief, he commanded a 51-day assault that killed more than 2,200 Palestinians, including 551 children. "Gaza will burn," Gantz said in a video posted on Meta in May, a direct threat that likely constitutes evidence of premeditated intent to commit war crimes. He says in the video over the footage of destruction, "Gaza residents, the last time that we met on Eid al-Fitr, I was chief of staff during Operation Protective Edge. If Hamas does not stop its violence, the strike of 2021 will be harder and more painful than that of 2014, he promised. The bigger question is why Meta, which has nearly a third of the world's population on its platform, is able to decide what or who is dangerous. It appears, as Columbia University professor Joseph Massot has recently written, that the criteria for who or what is considered dangerous or a terrorist depends more on a person's identity rather than what they do. It is not the act of terrorism that defines the actor as terrorist, but rather the opposite. It is the perpetrator's conferred identity as terrorist that defines his or her actions as terrorist in nature, Massot says. Meanwhile, as Meta cracked down on Palestinians, the Israeli Jewish extremists used instant messaging services to organize mob attacks on Palestinian citizens of occupied territories. This included Facebook or Meta groups, the Meta-owned service WhatsApp. There is no indication Meta takes this sort of misuse of its platform seriously while banning Palestinian political groups, journalists, and discussion at the Zionist regime's behest.